Hello, everyone. Welcome to Cloud 259 Running on Air. It's Sunday, November 23rd. This is episode 32. I'm Greg Lemo-Stein, and as always, I'm with my co-host, Bren Jones. It's Thanksgiving week, and I, for one, am very thankful to be back in the U.S. of A. for the holiday, and thankful to be in the same time zone as my partner, Bren.
Oh, thanks, Greg. Perhaps we should mention to listeners that for the last few episodes, since Greg now lives in London, generally we've been recording at about 4 a.m. Eastern and what about 10 a.m. or 9 a.m. British time, Craig?
Or some variations of that.
Sometimes
I'm in the middle of the night and you're not, but this is much more comfortable. So what do we have on today's show?
Okay, Greg. Well, tonight we're going to focus on two outstanding recent marathon performances. One last week at the Brooklyn Marathon, we talked to the winner of the Brooklyn Marathon, a Canadian, and we'll also, just at the top of the show, talk a bit about Daniel Gurka's performance at the Philadelphia Marathon. Daniel, a friend of ours and a runner with the Central Park Track Club, today came around the course in Philly in 2 hours, 38 minutes, and 15 seconds. We had Daniel on the show on episode 28. Which we recorded September 17th, so right when he was getting into the meat of his marathon training. Greg, tell us a bit about what Daniel did today.
Yeah, so he had just a 14.5-minute PR. That's about it. He skipped the entire 240s and went right to Cloud 238, as you said. Just an outstanding, amazing performance, and he just keeps getting better. We had him on the show, as you mentioned, and he shared with us some tips and some of his secrets, but maybe not everything, so we had to go snooping into his Strava files and really look back at what was the key to his success. So what did you see
from his training? You know, I tried as I might to get the secrets out of Dan, and he gave us many wonderful quotes. And in fact, I'm going to double back and try to get the transcript for that interview up on our site. But please, people, go back and listen to it because he does know some things. I think the proof is in the pudding, though. The pudding is the training. And I took another look at his Strava training, and one thing that's very noticeable about it is that every single week, it seems, you know, for the past 10 weeks, he has had at least one 14-miler and up at a very good clip. So I was heartened to see this because it aligns with my belief in how to train properly for a marathon. Also, the advice given to us from a few of our early guests on the show. You know, Daniel had some runs of, you know, 14, 15 miles at 6 minutes per mile, which is what he hit today in his race, but also 20-mile runs at about 7 minutes per mile or even a bit faster, thrown in with some half marathons in there. So basically, it's not just that he was running at distance, but he was running at distance at a healthy clip. I guess another thing to mention there is that he took so much time off of his marathon PR that, you know, the 20-mile run at 7 minutes per mile, perhaps he knew or he was aiming for 6 minutes per mile for the marathon. So it's not that 20-mile run was at marathon pace, but it was still very ambitious given his prior marathon times, which were nothing to sneeze at, mind you, at 2:52. But still, the leap that he made, it took a lot of imagination on Daniel's part to even think that was possible. But again, if you look at his training, he did put the work in at pace. And he, you know, another example of a few days of great work he did 15 miles at sub 7 minute one day. And the next night, he went to the Central Park workout and did 8 miles at sub six. So usually the day before a workout, will tend to pull back on the mileage or rest to have fresh legs. But, you know, Daniel was ambitious enough to go into that workout, certainly with some fatigue in his legs, and then he hit it hard. To make leaps in marathon PRs, you need to make leaps in training. Sometimes that takes a bit of imagination and a bit of guts, and I think that he showed that.
You know, that last point you made about the going into the workout on tired legs ties in really nicely with what Desi Linden told us on our last show about training on tired legs, or as the Hansons put it, cumulative fatigue, which is a good thing, something they aspire to. But it's something that seems to have worked well with Dan. And the other thing is, you know, these long paced runs, we can't say it enough. You have to work your way up to them. You can't just don't try it at home unless you're doing, starting off with six miles at marathon pace, or eight and then 10 and working your way up to it, because it's really a bear unless you're easing into it.
Yeah, for sure. So the next outstanding performance we'd like to focus on was put in by Lawrence Warriner. He is a fellow from Toronto who won the Brooklyn Marathon last Sunday, and we'll get to his interview in a minute. I'd just like to mention that for the rest of the episode, we'll also be taking a trip to the library, back to the library, Greg. We haven't done that in a while, where I'll discuss Al Michaels' new book. Greg, you've got a soapbox for us, I believe. And we will, on the Elite Scene, talk a bit about the US ARC 12K and Ekaden coming up, and we will respond to a tweet that a Twitterer named M pointed at us. But back to our interview. So the Brooklyn Marathon this year had a very interesting storyline for me going into it. And that is that the North Brooklyn Runners Club had won on the men's side the race 3 consecutive years. Each time it had been held, this was the fourth year of the Brooklyn Marathon. And they had the front runner going in, a fellow named Ben Leese. However, the day before the marathon, Ben and his wife had a baby. So very wisely, Ben did not run the race. At stake in the race was a $1,000 gift certificate from Jackrabbit Sports. And it was wide open. I asked Steve Lasto, the race organizer before the race, who he thought the top seeds were. He mentioned, that Ben probably wouldn't be running, but that JP Montes, who had won in 2011, would be running. He was a North Brooklyn runner guy. And a guy who wasn't on my radar, but who ended up winning, was this Canadian fellow named Lawrence Warriner. And what makes it even more an interesting story to me, not just that he broke the NBR streak, but was that he's a 51-year-old. And how often do people aged 50 and older win marathons? And I wanted to find out more about this guy, but I didn't want to learn too much before I interviewed him because I thought it'd be more fun going in sort of blind. So here is our interview with Lawrence Warriner. Enjoy. So tonight on the show, we're really psyched to speak with a Canadian, Lawrence Warriner. Who's Lawrence Warriner, you might ask? Lawrence Warriner was the winner of the 2014 Brooklyn Marathon, which happened just a week ago on Sunday. Lawrence won the fourth Brooklyn Marathon, which in a time of 2 hours, 43 minutes and 15 seconds. He had a nice gap of about 3.5 minutes over the second place finisher. And one thing that stood out in the results to us was Lawrence's age. He's a nice young 51 years young, I guess we should say, which is a bit unusual for a marathon winner. Lawrence Warriner, welcome to Cloud 259.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So Lawrence, right off the bat, I'll let our listeners know that we don't know much about you. You don't know much about us, but your story was just too much for us to resist. So when we first emailed on this, you wrote to me, it was a very special, strange, and fun day in Brooklyn. Let's start with the strange. Tell us what was strange about it.
It was, I've run New York the past 8 years, excepting the year of the hurricane. And so this year I was looking for something different, a smaller race, and it wasn't, I've been used to Boston and New York the last 8, 10 years each year, and this was a much smaller race, and it felt in the park, and we were staying right beside the park in a kind of a walk-up kind of house we had booked, and it was very much, it didn't have that huge marathon feel, it felt like a nice kind of race. I wasn't nervous. It was like just sort of walked up and like, okay, let's do a bunch of laps of the park. And it felt different. And then the field, I didn't know what to expect at all. And I didn't, and it was go out and just take, I took the lead right away and I went, uh-oh, bad idea. That's not how I run in any way. I'd rather be the hunter than the hunted. And so it was very strange to take the lead right away and then have no idea where anybody else was for a very long time. And then you start lapping people and it becomes very, not confusing, but you start wondering where you are and what's going on.
I've run that race before and I think it's fair to say it's confusing now. Now, tell us, just for those who haven't run Brooklyn who aren't familiar with it, tell us a bit about the course.
Well, it's in Prospect Park. There's sort of a large loop, similar to, in the same sense, Central Park has the large loop. The loop in Prospect Park, I think, is 3.3 miles. And the course, in a way, it's rolling, but it has one long hill from the south end of the park right up to the top, which is about, I guess, a mile and three quarters, I guess. Then there's some rolling hills at the top, and then it's kind of a long downhill, and you go do it again. So it's three small loops and then six large loops, and every time on the large loop, you have to climb the hill.
And you do that six times, right?
Yeah, yeah. And you there's two water stations, one on each side of the park, but you think you get up to the top, and there's a guy banging a pot, like you're up to the top, but then you hit some nice rolling hills, again, similar to the west side of Central Park, these rolling hills and nice long uphills that, you know, eat into your legs quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, you say you took the lead right away. Were you literally, you know, right out front 200 meters into the race, or did you run with anybody for a few miles, or?
No, I took it right off the line. As soon as the gun went, I just took the lead, and I could feel that it was, after just a short distance, it was substantial. I went, somebody's going to blow up today, and it's going to be me. So,
had you looked at the prior results from Brooklyn to sort of get a sense of what you might expect from the competition?
Yeah, I did. I looked at last year's results, and I saw sort of, I think it was mid-230s. I think there was a 234, 232, something in there, and I thought, well, I looked, maybe I can get third place. My partner and I were talking, well, maybe I can win my age and maybe third place.
Uh-huh.
We didn't really know the course that well, and training had been good but not great.
Were you aware that the guy who won last year was a very late scratch?
No, I didn't. They mentioned it at the start. They mentioned that he wouldn't be there, but I don't remember if they said why.
Right. Well, it's another thing that makes it an interesting story. So there's a club in New York called North Brooklyn Runners, and on the men's side, they've had a stranglehold on this race. The first year, a guy who finished second in your run, J.P. Montes, won it.
Yep.
In 2 hours, 43 minutes. And then a guy, Ben Lease, who won it last year. He won it in 2012. He won it last year. And he ran the New York City Marathon this year in 2 hours, 31 minutes, and 52 seconds. And he was going to run Brooklyn, except he and his wife had a baby the day before the race.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, wow.
So,
yeah, wow.
I know, right?
That's
so
amazing.
So wonderful for he and his family. And you broke the streak of North Brooklyn runners winning the Brooklyn Marathon.
That's what they said at the end. It was like, some Canadian guy, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was interesting.
Now, during the run, did you ever look back to see, you know, where the second place guy might be?
No, I mean, you know, as a runner, you can kind of feel, you get a feel, you listen to the cheers, like in the first couple laps, you're by yourself, so you listen a little bit for the cheers, you listen for the, you know, go man go kind of stuff. So,
right.
You know, but once you start mixing up with the crowd, my partner was helped. She actually joined in and helped. Nancy helped out one of the water stations, and so she was kind of keeping track on her phone the times, and she was giving me an idea of the gaps. But I'd go whizzing by, and she'd go, like, five, blah, blah, and I'd be like, okay, I know I'm either like 5 minutes ahead or like 10 seconds ahead. I have no idea. So,
right. Well, as it turned out,
I didn't really have a great idea, but by about halfway, I thought, this is mine as long as I don't blow up.
Good. Yeah, you had a, looking at the half marathon splits, you came through at 1:18:50, and the second place guy was at 1:22:23, so you had about 3.5 minutes on him.
Right.
Now, tell us about that second half of the race, though. I mean, did you run relaxed because you knew that, you know, you had a fairly safe lead, or were you running scared?
Well, the first half felt really, really great. I did Toronto, the Toronto waterfront, 3 weeks before, and that half felt pretty decent. I did that in 1:14:20, and so when I went through in 1:18, I thought, okay, that's a bit faster, but my goal was 2:40, and I thought, I feel really good, and I knew I had a fair lead. The guy on the bike was like, you know, you've got a bit of a lead, and I never heard any cheers, and I thought, well, I'm running really for time now. Like I was starting to map out the strategy in my head, sort of how I'm going to manage these hills over and over again, trying to get a mindset of, okay, hill six is going to feel like this, hill set or lap six is going to feel. So I really started to try to map out what I wanted to feel like and try to gauge my effort. I didn't slow down my effort. I really lost the time in the last mile and a half. My legs started shaking pretty bad. Like, I was like, man, I got to get the half the hill one more time, and my legs were shaking pretty bad.
Huh. But you felt, did you ever have any doubt that, you know, you'd win, or were you just thinking at that point, you know, I'll get to the finish line, I'll be fine?
Certainly over the years, marathons have not been my best friend, and I've blown up real good. But the last, say, 4 or 5 years, I seem to, a couple things happened which made a big difference in marathon running for me. And the last 4 or 5 years, I've been in the 240s a lot, and again, 242 at Boston. The race is, it doesn't feel as long anymore for me. Like, it used to be daunting and this huge thing. It didn't feel that long, I guess, because of the laps. And also, I'm getting used to managing it really, really a lot better for myself, and it's starting to feel almost like two half marathons, and certainly I'm not struggling as much as I used to. So I was really just focusing on, wow, I know this time's going to be pretty decent. Let's see how decent it can be.
So what have been the keys to that change, Lawrence? Has it been your training approach, or is it purely a sort of psychological on race day?
One big thing happened, like, you know, I was the typical guy, you know, lots of Bostons, lots of New Yorks. I did Philadelphia. I did Disney. I did Charlotte. I did a bunch of races and, you know, beautiful time, you know, getting in and hit, you know, 22, 23, things started shutting down, like coming up beside Central Park, I'd start to shut down a bit. And, there was a nutritionist from, one of the major, I don't know if I can say Gatorade, sat me down at one of the expos, and we sat and talked for like 25 minutes, and we talked about hydration. And of course, she was pitching the lemon lime Gatorade, which is awesome. But I started doing, you know, full cup of Gatorade every other mile instead of just, you know, which was a lot more than I was used to, and the difference was amazing. And then just I just vowed to make my long runs instead of 2:10, 2:15, more like 2.5 hours. And that made a huge difference. Like at Boston this year, I had a negative split, and I was able to accelerate just past and just zooming by. I felt like I could just change gears in the last 4 or 5 miles.
What pace do you do your long runs at?
Yeah, that's my friend I was running with this morning. He's like, how fast, you know, I do about 90% of my training on trails, single track trails in Toronto. I live downtown, and we actually have access to about 50K of single track trails down in the center of the city. And they're mountain biking trails. And I do those almost every day at full pace, as hard as I can every day.
Hmm. And how many miles a week? Or kilometers a week, if you prefer, being up there in Canada?
Yeah, kilometers, you know, despite my, even in my age, I think in miles, but kilometers. For a marathon, I'm usually up around 120 to 130 in kilometers. And again, 90% of that is going up or going down a hill.
So correct me if I'm wrong, that's about 70 to 80 miles a week?
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, Lawrence, the conventional wisdom for masters runners is to take more time for recovery. I often wonder if that is just conventional wisdom or what your thoughts are on that. It sounds like you're hitting it pretty hard every day.
Yeah, I find that, like, today we did again, I went out, we have a Philly part of Toronto called High Park, and I went out, we did 10 miles, just under 10 miles in 62, and I was like, man, this is going to hurt. And it hurt a little bit, but I think for me, it's always been train as hard as you can, and for me, I'm very fortunate. I rarely get hurt, if ever, and I really, the more I run, the better I feel. Like, I have to attain, I have to make up in mileage what I don't have in youth anymore. I really do. These guys, you know, JP was 27, and you know, I can't do that anymore. I have to be up around 120 or 130, and if I'm not, I just don't have those upper gears when I want to run fast at a half or whatever. I just don't have it.
Now, you mentioned that you've run New York a number of times and Boston. Do you know how many marathons you've run total?
It's either 28 or 29. I had an interesting streak of combined 18, I think, 18 or 19 New Yorks and Boston in a row. So like every year I would do Boston in the spring, New York in the fall. So I had like 18 of those in a row until this year. This was the one that broke the streak.
Huh. Wow. Now, and I know you're talented, but it's safe to say you didn't win any of those New Yorks or Bostons. Now, this was the first time you've won a marathon, correct?
Yeah.
So what, that moment that you crossed the tape, can you describe that?
It felt like a couple times in the last couple of years, I've hit a couple really nice races, and I know this sounds kind of silly, but I go, wow, what have I done? Like, this is new territory. Like, wow, I'm 51, and what have I done? And it feels like, you know, a little, sometimes it feels like a game changer. This feels a little bit like it. Like, you know what? I've done something new, and I kind of step back and I go, wow, that's kind of cool. I didn't expect this, and I feel like, wow. It's a huge step forward in confidence in terms of not only marathons, but, you know, there's, you know, I'm competing, like most of the races, I'm competing for masters titles or whatever against,
right,
you know, guys in their 40s. So it's nice to feel that validation, but also it's kind of like this scary kind of world of, well, what did I just do? Did I make a wish and win a marathon? I guess so.
And you won some money there, Lawrence, right? You won, was it $1,000?
Yeah. And I was like, wow, that's a lot of running gear.
yeah. So it came, what, in the form of a gift certificate to Jackrabbit? Is that right?
Yep. Yeah. And I've got to contact Steve, the guy, the really nice guy who does the NYC runs. They put on a really nice race, and I've got to get him to mail it. And we're actually thinking of heading back down in. They do a half in Central Park in mid-December. We might head down and run that.
Oh, nice. And then collect all the $1,000 worth of running gear at Jackrabbit.
That's right.
You'll have to bring down some empty suitcases.
Exactly.
I was just going to say, what does that bring your career money winnings to? Money?
A thousand and something. No. They have a big 10K in Toronto called Sporting Life, which tracks about 33,000. This year, I won a couple hundred bucks there, and you know, you win lots of shoes and, you know, gift cards and stuff like that. That's always nice. But $1,000 is kind of outside of what I'm used to, and it was kind of wow, $1,000. You know, I can get, yeah. We were in the store, and I was like, holy cow, they have some nice stuff. So,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, even though the Canadian dollar is pretty strong against the American dollar, historically speaking, still a pretty chunk of change here.
Yeah. Yeah. That's saying, I mean, New York City is probably one of my favorite places in the whole world, if not my favorite place, other than my hometown. And we actually had a place on the Upper West Side for a couple months, a few summers back, and just training in Central Park and training up the Hudson on Riverside and stuff. It was one of my favorite things to do.
Just one more question about your history of marathoning. What's your PR in the marathon?
It's the Boston this year, 2:42:12.
So you set your PR, and you also won your first marathon, both at, well, you must have been at least 50 at Boston,
yep,
and 51 now. What sort of single piece of advice, or how can you explain your PRs at this age? Is it just that you're doing more running now than you used to, or smarter running, or...
No, probably. I mean, I think the thing that I think of why it's working is my partner just flashed me hydration.
I don't drink enough.
She's like
that
would
Gatorade
be smart
tip that you
drink
got.
Water. Yeah. I think the biggest key is strangely belief in that it doesn't really make a difference. I find myself sometimes looking at the age and going, wow, I look around me and I go up to the starts of races and everybody, all the guys I race against are, 30s and 40s. And I'm like, I belong here. You know what? There's no reason I shouldn't feel good about being here. And I wear the same ripped shorts in every race. I didn't wear them in Brooklyn because a dog jumped on them and ripped them to shreds. But I would show up in these old ripped shorts, and I wear a cotton t-shirt when I run, not because I'm old school or anything, but it's like, maybe I don't look like I belong, and maybe my age doesn't say that, but I just believe in it, and I like, I belong here. There's no reason I don't belong here, and that kind of keeps me going, thinking, it doesn't really matter. As long as the results are there, don't ever believe that, because you're 51, and I thought, wow, yeah, but then I'll be 52 and 3 and 4 and 5 and 6. When's it going to end? And the results haven't, so why question them and just keep working as hard as I can?
That's great advice, Lawrence. I'll point out that the rest of the top five, the four guys behind you were age 27, 25, 20, and 27. So you taught those whippersnappers a thing or two. And you won you said you were looking to win your age category.
Yeah.
You won your age category by almost an hour. The second 50 and over male was a 3:39. So it was about 56 minutes. So.
Well, that's one thing I've noticed. As you get older, people in my age group, injuries are huge. And it's hard. It's, again, recovery and stuff is harder. And I've just been really, really lucky in terms of I can go out there and can run every day as hard as I want. And you reach, you guys probably know, you reach that point in your training where you can go, okay, today I'll do 25K, tomorrow I'll do 30K, and it feels great. And I just finish and I'm ready the next day.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm close to that now.
That's fantastic. And have you got any sort of winter running tips? I know the weather can be chilly, at least, up there in Toronto in the winter.
Well, last winter was the most brutal. You guys had the same thing. It was brutal. And, I'd come in with the big giant icicles on my face. I have a beard, a mustache, and, strangely, I still would run on the trails and, plow through some of them. I think the tendency is we have Boston to train for. You go to Boston, all these guys from Florida and some of the southern states show up with tans, and you've just come out of a blizzard and
right.
in minus 10 all winter. It's like the last 200 meters of a hill. You look at the last 200 meters of a hill and you go, this is where it's really going to, you work hard here, it's going to pay off.
Right,
so
right.
Winter running is where it sucks and it hurts and you're frozen, but it pays off because once April comes, you're going to be ready and you work as hard as you can.
Yeah, and at least you're not in Buffalo right now under 6 feet of snow and whatnot.
That's true. Close to it.
Yeah.
We drove down in a snowstorm. We drove back in a snowstorm, but unfortunately the weather was pretty decent for the race.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't think about that. You had to get through there to get back, didn't you?
yeah, it wasn't too bad. It was snowing on the way down through Syracuse. It snowed like crazy.
Yeah. Well, Lawrence, it's been, thank you so much for your time, for joining us. It's been great to hear about your race, and hopefully we can catch up with you when you're in New York. We have one last question that we ask
yep.
Everybody that we interview, and The name of our show is Cloud 259 because when Greg and I started the show, we were both 308 marathoners. So I've been able to get under three. Greg is on the cusp. And we want to provide one piece of expert advice, the best piece of wisdom you have, not only to get us PRs in the marathon, but to get all of our listeners, for those who are going to get under four, under three, you know, under 230, whatever it is. What do you think is the best piece of advice for running a PR in the marathon?
I think the sort of the two best pieces of advice I can give is always do hills and more hills. I mean, when you're training, hills are the key to everything. They provide you with that strength, and they provide your upper body with strength. And hills make all the difference in the world when you're training. Mm-hmm. And then the race. I mean, I looked at some of the advice before from some of the other people. Patience is everything. You try to get out in front of yourself, you try to bank time, especially at a race like Boston or even New York, you almost close your eyes to the people around you running. Just look at the crowds, look at and focus on the – my best advice I ever – people ask me, make your strides as tiny as you can. As soon as you lift your foot, put it back down as fast as you can. That's the key to running a fast race. Don't ever overstride. So as soon as your feet leave the ground, put it right back down, and that's the most efficient way of running, and it works for me every time. So when I'm in a race or I'm training and I really want – I'll focus really hard on my stride length, and I'll think, as soon as I lift, put it right back down. And that is the most efficient way to run I've ever seen, and – people go, wow, it's such a difference. I say, yeah, it's huge.
Interesting. And do you, is that just for a marathon, or for what distances would you recommend that?
Any. I would intentionally go out and run like all you're thinking about is lift your foot, put it back down, and just do that, and you'll see how short your stride is.
So you get higher turnover then, I imagine.
Yeah. People comment on my turnover all the time. They go, wow, your turnover is incredibly fast. And I say, yeah, I don't want to be in the air long, and I don't want to overstride. And it saves so much energy, and it saves your calves and your quads so much work. You're not lifting as far. You're not reaching as far. And you're hitting your stride point much better. You're hitting more in the forefoot instead of landing on your heel. You're doing it's so much more efficient. So I tell people, as soon as you lift your foot, put it back down, and your stride length will be so much shorter and so much more efficient and so much faster. You'll notice yourself speed up immediately.
Do you ever count your turnover? Do you ever count like your paces per minute, or you just concentrate on getting your feet down?
No, just getting my feet down. And then for about a year, I was building a new cottage out, and there's sand dunes, and I was training in the sand dunes. And I was looking at I'd be able to see on wet days my footfalls, and they're in a direct, like, line. There's no overlap either way. So, again, efficiency in stride, and, you know, my stride is always pointing forwards. Never toes are never anywhere but directly in front of me, and the stride length is really short.
Lawrence, that's fantastic. That's the first piece of advice we've had from any of our guests that's focused on biomechanics on stride. So that's I want to go outside right now and do it. It's 9:35. I want to go put my feet down.
It's a cool thing. When you try it and you actually try to run that way, you'll go, wow, this feels so different, and I feel like I'm probably not trying that hard.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of that's hills. On hills, you get your feet down as fast as you can, right? And again, on trail running, you get them down pretty fast as well because there's roots and all those rocks and everything. So you're managing your stride a lot more than if, you know, just going out. I think there's a lot of value in actually thinking while you run about your mechanical processes.
Absolutely. Wonderful.
Fantastic, Lawrence. Well, you know what? We're going to keep up with your own progress, and we'll keep in touch because we want to keep our listeners informed of, you know, how you keep progressing from here onwards. So thank you again so much for joining our show, and we'll catch up with you soon.
Thank you very much. It was a lot of fun.
So that was our interview with Lawrence Warner, and it goes to show, I believe, Greg, that a bit of training plus wisdom can trump age, mm-hmm. even into your 50s. And it should give hope to a lot of us that we can keep improving in our distance runs. So I should mention also the women's winner at Brooklyn was a teammate of ours, a Central Park Track Club runner named Kelly Gillen. And she ran 3 hours, 6 minutes, and 47 seconds, and she had a negative split. So aren't many people on that course that run a negative split. It's a very tough course, but she went out in 134, came back in 132. And she also won the race in 2011, its first year. So she is a two-time champion of the Brooklyn Marathon.
She also won the Hamptons Marathon the year that I ran it. She beat me, and she beat all the women in the field 2 or 3 years ago. So she's got a number of victories to her credit.
So next year there are plans. Well, Steve Lasto, the organizer, the head of New York City Runs and NYC Runs, I should say, and the organizer of the Brooklyn Marathon, has been planning, I think, to move the race into the streets of Brooklyn from Prospect Park. I think that's been a goal for a while. And Greg, there's another group looking to run a race in those streets. Is that right?
Yeah. So the competitor group who puts on the Rock and Roll Marathon and Half Marathon series is planning to have a half marathon in the streets of Brooklyn. And that would be in the fall of next year, is that right? So
yeah, they're looking to do it in October. And in fact, on Twitter, M sent us this article in the Wall Street Journal that described those plans. And we'd like to thank M for bringing that article to our attention. Mm-hmm. And it was an interesting article, and I've read a few clips on this, in part because Steve has been looking to get his marathon into the streets, and now we've got the competitor group, a different group that does races all across the country, and they're looking to put a half marathon onto the streets in Brooklyn, but a big one, 20,000 runners or so, perhaps. And if you close all the streets for a half marathon in Brooklyn in October, would Brooklyn, the powers that be willing to close off some streets in November for a full race for Steve? Would that affect his chances? In the article that in the Wall Street Journal article that M pointed to us, Steve said he hoped not, but maybe. So what's your take on this piece and on the competitor group moving in, Greg?
Well, I think it may not be as big a deal as it might appear. It kind of depends on whether or not they sink some money into having a lot of elites at that race and whether it gets a lot of notoriety. But I'll mention that the competitor group has already had a 10K in Brooklyn for a while now, and it hasn't gotten much attention. It's been kind of under the radar and much, much smaller than the Brooklyn half that already exists in the springtime, which has been a very successful race by New York Roadrunners, a very big race, and which sells out like lightning quick. And it's, I think that's a big race of about 20,000 or something close to that, maybe less. But I don't know. It may not disrupt anything. And you know, the Brooklyn Marathon's move to the streets of Brooklyn is reminiscent, of course, of the New York Marathon, which, as some people may know, for its first 5 or 6 years was within Central Park. And then in 1976, the first year Bill Rogers won, was the first year it became a five borough race. So I think we've been waiting, and Steve Lasto has been planning to bust out of Prospect Park for quite some time, and let's hope he can do it.
I think this all points to the demand for races in New York City, and when I see the demand for races in general, I think that's a good thing. Running is growing. If the competitor group where they hold national races wants to also hold a race in New York, more power to them. I think that in a way, you feel for Steve, who's been trying to get the race into the streets, and NYC Runs has, a lot of people love their races and the hot cocoa they get at the end of them. And it's a very different experience from a roadrunner's race. It's a lot, certainly the Brooklyn Marathon's a far different experience from the New York City Marathon. You get 500 finishers rather than 50,000. So it's a much smaller, far more laid back race. It's a different feel. A Brooklyn half marathon by NYC Runs with 20,000 runners, I have no idea what that would look like. Mm-hmm. I I do think, though, that claiming it doesn't really make sense to claim territory. You know, Steve's group did a full marathon in Central Park, which is quite interesting because they, not the exact same course that the original New York City Marathon was, but, you know, 26 miles in Central Park. And I think when NYC runs started, there was a little bit of talk of, ooh, are they moving in on NYRR's turf? And to his credit, I don't think that, you know, Steve has played that card. I think he realized pretty quickly that, you know, that wouldn't be wise. But on the same token, you know, NYR looks at competitor group and sort of says, so what? You know, good for them. Have a race in Brooklyn. Enjoy. You know, you're feeding our mission of helping get people healthy in New York or whatnot. And you know, I think ultimately that Steve does a lot of races in Brooklyn, and he will continue to. And I don't think competitor group will quash that. I do hope that his hopes of getting a marathon into Brooklyn outside of Prospect Park sooner rather than later aren't quashed by this. But if it does happen, who knows? Maybe competitor group has such a successful race that there could be a number of marathons in Brooklyn. Or Greg, better yet, what was that idea that you mentioned
Well,
before we went live here?
yeah, I think all these groups need to be a little bit more forward-thinking and focus on the next frontier, which is your neighborhood, Bren, Queens,
That's right, baby.
where I'm reading in the New York Times, among other places, Queens is the next Brooklyn. All the hipsters are there now because maybe they've been priced out of Brooklyn. But so think ahead, running groups. Let's have a Queens full, a Queens half. Would you sign up for those, Brent? Step out your front door and into a marathon.
There's a local race here, a Forest Park 4 miler I did once. That was a lot of fun. Yeah, let's get some races in Queens. I mean, for a long time, I thought the New York City Marathon, though it's nice that they have the same course every year. I mean, there's a lot more to the five boroughs than the little strips that we run every year in the New York City Marathon. So yeah, opening up in the streets of New York, I think, is a great thing. It's people against cars, and I go with the people, the runners. You know, if we're talking one day out of 365 or whatnot, that's long been my belief. And ultimately, I don't really care who's organizing it. With competitor group, I should say that when they stopped supporting elite runners, or they stopped giving them award money, prize money at the races, I did say that I'm withdrawing, or I'm not going to run any competitor group races. I'm going to ban them. But I've never run one. I still haven't run one. And now they are supporting elites again. In fact, I think they're supporting elites more than they had before they stopped supporting them. So, you know.
Do they still have those premium potties, though? Do they
If
still
that,
charge them?
I don't know about that. I mean, but that's a good point. I mean, all of these race organizers are, in a way, trying to make livings by running races. And I'm all for people running races, so I don't have a problem with that. But Greg, you've got the system that you've now tasted in Britain for a little bit of free races, right? Free park runs.
Yeah,
And
that's
ultimately, I mean, that seems to me to be, you know, ideal, where, you know, you line up and you race and you get a time, you know what the time is, and you know, you don't have to pay for it. I mean, that sounds awesome. What is your park run experience been?
yeah, I've run three of them in the same hilly course, and it's a great scene. It's just got a great feel to it. It's the fact that it's free, the fact that there are volunteers, it has a real nice just taste to it. It just makes it all seem like a community event, and you see the same people there every week, and you get to run the same course and see how you're progressing. Interestingly, competitor group has been sued because of its use of volunteers, because apparently you're not, or at least the argument is that you can't use volunteers if you're a for-profit corporation. But of course, Parkrun in the UK is a non-for-profit and is not charging, and so the volunteers there are certainly appropriate and very, very much appreciated by the runners. So it's cool. It's very cool, and I suspect at some point it will take off in the U.S. Although it may take away some revenues from these for-profit running groups, at least in the shorter in the shorter distances.
Yeah, and I'm curious whether there's any sort of tension there. Do you sense in England, do you sense that, is there any pushback to park run? Is there an NYRR of London?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, there are races of 10Ks and there are half marathons. There are races in the Royal Parks. I'm not aware of like one dominant race organizer, though. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong. I'm you know, still a newcomer.
Right, right.
But I wouldn't be surprised if there are less revenues in running races in London because of the presence of parkrun.
Huh. And do you think that parkrun, do you feel like it's more of a lifestyle movement, or do you think that it's a lot of competitive runners, just as you would see in a, you know, in a NYRR race? Though, to be fair, at NYRR race, it do seem like lifestyle runs to a certain degree. You got a lot of competitive runners, but also a lot of people who are out there just to stay fit and might not be too worried about their times.
I think, I don't know, it's hard to say, but I think that most park runners are, you know, running hard and trying to get a good time. It is timed, and the results do go up on the internet. But I would say the focus is on getting fit, and it is a lifestyle, and the schmoozing afterwards is important. But I think there are also a lot, you know, there is a club scene, running club scene in London that's been around for a long time and will be around for a long time more. And there are lots of cross country races, and there are different races for much more competitive focused, runners.
Mm-hmm.
So I think parkrun is more relaxed than your typical New York road runners race, which is a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And in that informal and yeah, I'll say that the NYC run, Steve Lasso's races, are generally a bit more relaxed than the Roadrunners races as well, bit more informal as well, though, you know, the important things, you know, there are some competitive runners, you get timed, and that's, at the end of the day, that's what you're looking for, if you're a competitive runner, or even if you're not. So,
you know what's one more great thing about park run? No safety pins.
Is that right?
Yeah, you have a little key ring or a piece of paper that has a barcode on it, and you just someone swipes you when you come through the finish line, and that's all.
Someone swipes you when you come through the finish line.
Right.
So you have to stop and be swiped.
Well, someone presses a button when you cross the finish line, and then they swipe you. They triangulate. So right.
In a way, that's kind of old school. Somebody at the finish line has an important job. It's not just electronics. Right.
Yep, and they're volunteers again, so much appreciated.
Well, these are issues that we could go on for a long time, but let's move on to the next topic, as we do want to have a podcast. It's not 2 or 3 hours long. Apologies to people who are doing extremely long runs and like that sort of thing. Let's talk quickly on the elite. Let's shift the elite scene, Greg. I'll mention at the US ARC, we put up a quick news article on our site, cloud259.com, which we do from time to time, a mini preview of the US ARC. And the drama I thought there was, you know, would Sarah Hall possibly be able to run with Molly Huddle? And I suspected not, but she had a great incentive, and that was to win the cumulative series. And to win the cumulative series, she would have had to beat Molly Huddle, or Molly would have to run terribly, which was unlikely. Now, we knew going into the race that Sarah Hall had actually been running very well recently, and there hadn't been any recent results for Molly Huddle, so we didn't know what kind of shape she was in, though we assumed that given she had incentive to win the cumulative title, she was pretty fit. And so I woke up and watched this race, Greg, and I love watching these US ARC races because the coverage is pretty much just about running. You don't get all of these stories that are thrown in there to draw in people who might possibly become interested in running. The telecast is pretty much there for people who already are interested in running. So, and, you know, since it's not this amazingly huge production in a very difficult place to shoot, you don't lose the feed. And you don't go to commercials, pretty much.
Right. You don't go to commercials at the key moment of the breakaway at the very end. Right?
Yeah. You don't lose the entire men's race and whatnot.
Yeah, that's right.
So as it played out, I thought it was a very brave run by Sarah Hall, because Huddle is certainly a, stronger runner. I think that's not a very controversial thing to say. Huddle's at the top of her class, 5K American record holder. She beat Shalane Flanagan at this race last year. And Hall ran with her for about 5K. And then, she probably was hurting pretty good because she ended up finishing fourth, not second. Surprisingly, in second place was Emily Sisson, who's a training partner of Molly Huddle. And so I'd say if I could have one piece of advice to Lawrence Warner, who we had early on the show, find yourself a Molly Huddle to run with or an Emily Sisson to run with, because it seems to me that running with somebody can help. Certainly it must be helping Emily Sisson to be running with Molly Huddle. Kim Conley came in third, and Conley's a runner I love to watch. I wonder if she ever loses in a close battle at the finish line, because she always seems to be coming out on top. Here she chased down Sarah Hall, beat her by a few seconds. And Conley is training for the Houston Half Marathon Championships in January, and I very much look forward to seeing how she'll do there. Interestingly, Hall beat Conley by several minutes in a half marathon a few weeks before this race, but in the interim, Conley tweeted that she had put in a 100-mile week, and I think that she'll round into shape, and she's... she's another runner who I think understands that the proof is in the pudding. It's all about the training that you do. Mm-hmm. On the men's side, quickly, Brian Schrader was a surprise winner, setting a national record in the 12K of 34 minutes, 11 seconds. And Greg, you mentioned before the show, this was his first race of that distance, 12K. And we're not sure if he's run a 10K. So I say, let's get him in the marathon. Hey, if it's working to go longer, keep going longer.
Yep. No, it's great to have a new name to keep an eye on. And he was unknown to us and unknown to a lot of others. You mentioned Sarah Hall running a brave race. I think on the men's side, the brave race was run by Aaron Braun, who really took the lead for most of it and got outkicked at the end. But he did 98% of the work for most of that race.
Yeah, he had quite a train coming off of him, too. But it seems like he did all that he could have done to run the legs out of any other kickers. And, he just didn't have the speed, the same kind of 1500 meter speed that, Brian Schrader has. So, but yeah, wonderful to see this guy who's like seeing the Kansas City Royals in the World Series.
Like that'll ever happen. Oh, it did. Right. So let's look ahead very short future to tomorrow. There's an event in Japan that I wanted to just highlight because it gets very little attention here in the US or in London, but it's all the rage in Japan are these Ekidens, and the Chiba Ekiden is taking place on Monday. As many people may know, the Ekiden is a relay race, and it's often a marathon distance, but in six stages with six different runners running various distances from 5K to 10K. And I mention it because Kenya, which has won three in a row of these Chiba Ekidens, has a field that is not particularly strong, at least from the looks of things, from a PR perspective. Matthew Kosorio is the headliner. He has a sub-59 half before he got actually busted for drugs. But now he's back. But the other runners, not so impressive or not household Kenyan names. The U.S. team has a bunch of very interesting names, names that our listeners will know well. Two of our guests, Christo Landry and Tyler Purnell, are involved. Tyler is leading off with a 5K, and Christo is running, is batting third with a 10K. Jake Riley is a very good runner with the Hanson's Distance Project. He's in the mix. And then on the women's side, Katie Matthews, Liz Costello, Rachel Ward, not the absolute top tier of women's roadrunners, but they're all young and they're all very capable, and they all have PRs in the 1540s for 5K. So I'm thinking that we may make some noise at this Ekiden. It'd be nice if it got some coverage. Japan Running News is a great blog that covers everything that happens on the running scene in Japan. But I think these Ekidens are cool because it's country against country, and it's would be great to see one televised. I don't think it's available in this case, but we'll look for the results.
Yeah, interesting to see those guys go out there coming off of marathons here in the U.S. Riley and Landry and Pinnell all did fall marathons, and I would love to see us do well over there, and also, you know, perhaps we should have more Ekadins here in the States. And I'll mention Steve Lasto again. His group NYC Runs has done an Ekadin in Central Park in December in the past. It's probably on again this year. I'm not certain about that, but that's been a really fun race. It's a, you know, a road race relay. You know, there's something to a team, having a team element to road race, which is a lot of fun. And
yep, sure is.
All right, Greg. Well, let's move to the library. The library's been closed for a while, and truth be told, I didn't actually read this book, but I did listen to the whole thing. So recently, I listened
on a run. Did you listen on a run?
No, not on a run. Actually, sitting at my desk at work. So I listened to a book written by Al Michaels titled You Can't Make This Stuff Up. This is a book that just came out recently. And Al Michaels is a sports announcer, one of the best of our generation. The book isn't about running. It's about his life in broadcasting. And he did talk about running briefly, though. He has covered some track and field at the Olympics. And one event that he did cover, and he seemed to, you know, cover all sorts of the big cultural touchstones of our generation, Greg, was the Zola Bud Mary Decker race in 1984 at the LA Olympics. That race was one in which the very young South African runner Zola Bud, who was running for England, got tangled with the American runner Mary Decker. Decker was the favorite heading into the race. Their legs got tangled early in that race, and Decker went down. The crowd started booing. Decker blamed Bud after the race, and it was only after watching the replays a bunch of times that I think the commentators understood or realized that the fall was not really Bud's fault, that in fact Decker had clipped Bud from behind, not the other way around, and not that Bud had intentionally tripped Decker. So at any rate, Al Michaels talks about this because he was in the booth calling the race. Now, he deferred to Marty Licori, the runner, on this point. Licori was broadcasting it, and Licori immediately thought that Bud was at fault. And Michaels talks about this and how, you know, Michaels regretted not sort of questioning him on it at the time. The next day, Michaels also writes about, you know, the attempt that they made the next day to do an apology on air. Or Licori to do not a retraction, but upon further review, I don't blame Bud. And interestingly, you know, it wasn't just the American broadcast that didn't get that right. I was looking back at a YouTube of that, and the legendary British broadcaster David Coleman was calling that race, and he also initially blamed Bud. So, you know, it couldn't have helped Bud at that time that the commentators of the race had gotten it wrong. Certainly that shapes public perception.
But Michaels knew, or Michaels felt, that it was not Bud's fault at that immediately.
Yeah, he did, but he didn't. He regretted questioning that on the air while he was calling it. And Michaels doesn't have many regrets in the book, so it did stand out to me a little bit. He's got a few, but not many. But it's incredible in listening to this book. It's highly entertaining because, you know, just anecdotes like being in an episode of Hawaii Five-0 with Christopher Walken. You know, like he announces as a young man, he was an announcer for the Hawaii Islanders. That's how he got his start, the baseball team. And he's got some good anecdotes there, including one about Bobby Valentine. And, you know, working Monday Night Football with Dennis Miller. O.J. Simpson was one of Michael's good friends, so he's got some opinions about, you know, Simpson's skills as a broadcaster and also, you know, what went down with O.J. Simpson. Also, he riffs on Howard Cosell and Chris Collinsworth and some of the people he shared the booth with and some of the athletes he's covered. He talks about broadcasting during the San Francisco Giants-Oakland A's World Series when the earthquake during the earthquake World Series, basically when he was live broadcasting and an earthquake hit. So it was very enjoyable for me because, like many people our age, Greg and I were both in our 40s. You know, I grew up consuming tons of sports, as I'm sure many runners did. And, So it was sort of a nice trip down memory lane, and to see it through the eyes of a broadcaster, particularly when Greg, you and I are doing, in a way, a form of broadcasting, it was a very enjoyable listen. And I highly respect Michaels. I think he's a no BS kind of announcer, and he's also a little bit old school. It's interesting to him reflect on ESPN as sort of the new kid on the block, and you know how journalism has changed a little bit since ESPN. Yeah, good stuff. Good stuff.
Very good. And good job finding the track and field nugget in that book.
Well, of course, I was listening for that. Yeah. I was hoping that he had covered some track, and I didn't have much recollection of it. But, you know, to be fair, when I was a kid, I wasn't really paying that much attention to track. I was paying a lot more attention to, you know, college basketball, Syracuse Orange Men and Pearl Washington against Patrick Ewing and the Georgetown Hoyas.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Same here.
So, Greg, I'll shut the door on the library and pretend I was reading in there, even though I was actually listening. And let's turn to you for a soapbox. You've been pretty reliable with the soapboxes of late. What have you got tonight?
Well, Brent, there are many ways in which the sport of distance running hurts itself in the marketing department. We've talked about it in some of our soapboxes. This time, I want to talk about awards. The IAAF announced its World Athletes of the Year last week, and the winners were a pole vaulter, Renaud Levillenay of France, and a shot putter, Valerie Adams of New Zealand. So they were not runners. They were field events. And I guess that therein lies the problem, that the sport is defined as athletics, not distance running. So first off, there's an obvious problem with this. How do you compare a Renaud Levillenay and a Dennis Cometto, for instance?
Right.
One broke the pole vault record by a half an inch or 1 centimeter, and the other broke the marathon record in the same year by 16 seconds. So what's more impressive, half an inch or 16 seconds? I don't know how we can tell. But more than that, I'm a fan of running. I have enormous respect for these field athletes. In fact, you and I were covering the Adidas Jeep Grand Prix in New York, and right. We were treated to a great matchup by the two high jumpers, Barshim and Bondarenko. But that aside, I would like to see an award for runner of the year, specifically distance runner. And I don't think that's much of a stretch. I looked it up on Google, and I couldn't find any such award. I Googled runner of the year, and the results I saw were a Minnesota runner of the year, a Fresno race series runner of the year. There's a Buffalo News runner of the year, who's dealing with some snow right now, probably. So we're going to start one here. And Bren, I'm going to put you on the spot right off the bat. I'm going to give you three nominees for male runner of the year, distance runner, and three for female runner of the year. And you've got to pick the winner. So on the men's side, I've got as the nominees Dennis Cometto, Wilson Kipsang, two marathoners, and one 800 runner, Nigel Amos. On the women's side, we've got Genzebe Dibaba, who's Tarunish's younger sister, who had a great indoor season, Mary Kataney, who just won New York, the marathon, and Jenny Simpson, the American, who happens to be the world's best miler right now. So who are you going to pick? I'm not going to express a view. I'm not expressing a view. I'm a consumer of this. Of this award. I'm going to listen to who you pick.
All right. So you think it's unfair to compare shot putters and pole vaulters to runners, but not 800 meter runners to marathoners. to parse Nigel Amos. I love Nigel Amos. And for those who haven't watched, please go back and watch the Rhodesia 2012 London Olympics 800 meter run. But this time, look at who's in second place, not at Rhodesia. That was the night I think Nigel Amos announced himself to the world, though everyone was watching Rhodesia there, of course. He tied the world record at that point. Amos was out for a year, and then he came back this year, and he actually got the best of a coming back from injury Rhodesia, so setting up many great 800 meters in the years to come. But though Amos had a great year, I'd say I'd take Kipsang. Cometto set the world record, but Kipsang won London and New York. You can't really argue with that. Kipsang beat a great field in London and beat a very good field in New York. you win two marathon majors, and unless your name is Rita Jeptu, you're not you'll get the award from me here. I think that you know, it's interesting that Meb is not on that list for you, but you know, if you said who's the top American runner, is it Meb or Jenny Simpson? That would be really tough.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I think Kipsang over Meb is fair. Kipsang beat Meb head to head, and you know, Meb though did beat Kometo. Kometo was in Boston, correct?
And he DNF'd.
So it goes to show that you know, the world record holder was at the Boston race, as was Lalisa De Sisa, right? The one who came in second at New York.
That's right.
So he also was at Boston. So goes to show that there was very high quality competition at Boston, Boston this year, the race at Meb won, but it wasn't, those guys did not have a good day. So yeah, I'll go with Wilson Kipsang. I don't think, that's a very controversial pick. I think the women's is tougher. So Kinzebe Dibaba, Mary Kataney, Jenny Simpson. I mean, Mary Kataney is a fantastic runner. She did a fantastic half and won New York.
Yeah, she ran the Kataney won, in addition to New York, the Great North Run, and she did it. She broke Paula Radcliffe's course record, and I believe that was the second fastest half marathon of all time, although it's technically not a record eligible course. So good year by Mary, although she didn't run the first half of the year because she was coming back from maternity leave.
Kinzebe Dibaba had the indoor, set some records in indoor track. And then I think she had a decent season outdoors, but she wasn't as impressive as she was indoors. And Jenny Simpson had a very dramatic comeback victory in the Diamond League series to win the series for the women's 1500/mile. And we saw her win the Fifth Avenue mile. That was neat. And you know, she granted us a nice interview after the race. So, Greg,
I see where you're going.
How can I go?
You're talking yourself into it.
How can I go against Jenny Simpson? Oh, man. Simpson versus Dibaba. I'll take Kataney. I'll take the quick route out. Kataney.
Oof. I thought you were going to go Simpson there. Okay.
Yeah. It's like those House Hunter shows where you think they're going to take one of these two houses and then you have taken the third. I mean, Kataney ran a 105 something in the half.
Yep.
And then won New York.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. You know,
Are you changing again?
No, I'm not changing again. Who do you take, Simpson or Meb? For American Runner of the Year.
Oh, that's a tough one. I think, you know, there's a clear choices for American runners of the year.
Or, you know,
I think
Rupp, or you know, who you could throw some other names in there, but of those two.
It's tough. I mean, Meb is the sentimental favorite. It's something.
So we're going against Meb again. Just say it.
We're
out
going Meb again. We're picking Simpson Meb because again. Simpson is the best in her discipline right now in the world.
Greg, Meb is never going to be on our show. Yeah, you know, we'll right. ask him. Understand. If you listen to any of our back episodes, we never give him any credit.
It's terrible. Meb, he's the best. You're an awesome he's the greatest. Guy. We love him. Please come on our show.
All right, so Greg, so why don't you answer the same question posed to me? It's Kometo, Kipsang, Amos. Who do you take?
Kipsang. I agree with your points.
All right, Dibaba, Kataney, Simpson.
I think of those runners, Kataney is the most talented, but Simpson was the only one of the three that had a complete year without any weak parts, and I'm going to give it to Simpson.
There was one cross-country race that she didn't run that well at.
Ah, okay. You had to know about that. It's not her main focus right now.
Yeah, very true.
Cross-country.
Very
so true. It's just very, very cool that she's in the discussion and legitimately, you know, could be the runner of the year.
Yeah.
Well, that was fun. All right. So I think that's our show for today. And as always, we can be reached at our email is cloud259@outlook.com. We can be reached on Facebook. Give us a like or send us a message. We're on Twitter at cloud259.com. And where else are we? We're on Strava.
Yeah.
We have a Strava team. And where else?
We're everywhere. Facebook.
We're everywhere.
Yeah.
So we will see you next time on Cloud 259 Running on Air. Good night, everyone.